This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 10th of October, 1954. The title of this lecture is Route 1, Step 10. This tape is 15 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
We will now take up R110. R110, Route 110, an exteriorization drill or process. Route 110 is not solely confined to Route 1. You will find it also over in Route 2. This step is, have Pre-Clear discover things he wouldn't mind occupying the same space with him. Now that is the idea behind all happiness. You can only have something when you've got a universe or when you've got some space. And get an individual with the idea of having this. It's only necessary to ask him many, many times, what wouldn't you mind occupying your same space now? Give me something else that you wouldn't mind occupying your space. He'll tell you air, water, ideas, anything he tells you. You don't care. You just want the question answered. What wouldn't you mind occupying the same space with you? And again, what wouldn't you mind occupying the same space? What wouldn't you mind occupying the same space? Now, this is not a short process. You can keep this process up with an individual for a couple of hours, always with benefit. You may run on somebody inside or outside. When you run on somebody who is exteriorized, he's liable to have the devil's own time trying to figure out how he could get something to occupy the same space he's occupying, particularly if he's in good shape. But he's got to manage this. He's got to know what this is all about. Really, he will move around and occupy the same space as other objects for a while and do all sorts of things. You're not interested too much in what he's doing. You just want to give him the process and get him finally into the idea that things can occupy the same space as a thing. What you are knocking to pieces is the basic postulate which makes a universe possible, and you are knocking that postulate to pieces. And this is simply this. The basic postulate is, for any universe which has space and energy, two things cannot occupy the same space. Alfred Lord Kaczynski did not invent this. It was invented about 74 trillion years ago for this universe. Two things cannot occupy the same space. If you will study general semantics, you will discover that they teach this. And it makes madmen out of them. They teach you two things cannot occupy the same space. Those two are not the same cigarette. They are two different cigarettes, if only because they are not occupying the same space. Ah, buoy. The space is a postulate. So if you postulate that they can't occupy the same space, they can't. If you postulate they can, they can. It's just a matter of you making up your mind about it. So if we have somebody having difficulty with his language, difficulty with the universe around him, who is an avid student of general semantics, which is taught in every university in the land now, by the way, they teach students that nobody really knows what anybody else is talking about, because every word means something different to everybody else. I'm afraid that coffee means coffee. Of course, it can have associative reasonings to it. You could have an association with coffee, but you still said coffee. Coffee, the fellow says, plus my associations with coffee. The other fellow says coffee plus my associations with coffee. You're still talking about coffee. The general semanticist is always thinking in terms of associative lines and masses and definitions and reasons why, you see. Significance, 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 significance. Now, I'm not tramping on general semantics. I'm glad general semantics was around. I studied it for 10 minutes once. And under a very, very good teacher, Robert Heinlein, he told me all about general semantics, and I was very happy to learn about general semantics. Several general semanticists since have undertaken my education, and they have quit with horror. Because they get just up to this point, they are not physicists, or they have never studied the physical universe. They get up to this point, they say, now you understand the two things cannot possibly occupy the same space. Oh, I'm afraid that we're at a divergence right at this point. That's the way you make the universe solid. That's how these general semanticists get ridges around. That's why they get tongue-tied and go out of communication. They get this repostulated, repostulated, repostulated. The two things can't occupy the same space. And that makes an energy mass. That makes terminals. That makes all sorts of weird things. See? That gives you a universe. In addition to this fellow having a physical universe, you're asking him to build a universe again around himself, in his mind. Words to a general semanticist become lumps of lead. Everything takes on a mass form. Naturally would, because that's how you make mass, isn't it? Two things cannot occupy the same space, you say. Therefore, by postulate, that terminal is over there and this terminal is here. You have to first say, however, if you're going to get these terminals apart, two things can't occupy the same space. You have to say that. See, you have to postulate that. These two things are apart and they cannot occupy each other's space. This will make them, each one of them, a unit object. We've got two unit objects now. We've got individuation. See? They say these two things are entirely separate. Each one has a personality. Why? They've got to go on having a personality at the end of time. Why? Because they can't occupy the same space. This is a very important thing to know in processing, because your fellow who is sitting there having a lot of difficulty, he has a thetan exteriorizing, he's got big masses of energy around him. There's only one common denominator to the things he's convinced of. Of course, he's convinced their energy, convinced their space, and so forth, naturally. But much more important than that postulate is this basic consideration. This basic consideration. He considers that two things cannot occupy the same space. For instance, he does not believe that he and his wife could occupy the same space. She is an individual, he is an individual. Oh, wait a minute. You'd have to be way downstairs in kindergarten not to have gone in somebody else's head and pulled a couple of motor controls one way or time or another. Sure, he is a thetan can occupy somebody else's space, but it's only by postulate that his body and his wife's body cannot occupy the same space. That's what makes them two different individuals. You break that postulate down, and Lord knows what's going to happen. Actually, you get freedom, because it's the basic restriction. All aberration is restriction. And that is the fundamental common denominator of all restriction. Two things cannot occupy the same space. All right, how important is this? Why are we stressing it? Is it an important theory? No. I tell you, I have enough theories. I have a file in here, which is called Old Cuffs. And there's enough theory and speculation and so forth on those, so much so that we decided to start to photostat them on the backs of the wasted pages of the PABs. You know, just have them shoot an old cuff at random. Boy, is that going to take some of these boys who figure out in the field and throw them for a loop, because some of these things are not secretive to anything we're doing. You know, they're just suppositions and so forth. Theories. Nobody will ever have to remedy my having this in terms of theories. There's no scarcity of them. There are just billions of theories. That's the one thing I'm perfectly willing to agree on, that there can be more theories than there are coyotes. And that's a lot of theories. Anyhow, when we have this postulate in the bank, a person who firmly believes it cannot believe that he can exteriorize. Because if he believes two things cannot occupy the same space, then it becomes impossible for him to assume that he is one thing and the body is another thing. Are you following me? So he will have to tell you, if he's sitting in a body, that he is a body. You got that? See? Yeah, I'm right here, and two things can't occupy the same space, so I can't be occupying the same space as a body, can I? Isn't that logical? Well, it sounds logical enough to him, so he won't exteriorize. And this is also your common denominator of non-exteriorization. If you were to take R110 as a good process, how would you remedy his interiorization? You just keep asking him this question for hours and hours and hours and hours. You give me some more things that could occupy the same space. You're occupying some more things, some more things, some more things. And all of a sudden he gets the creepy notion, because it's just a postulate on the track, you see? It's just a consideration, like ice cream is good or ice cream is bad. It's just the same order of magnitude. All of a sudden he gets the sneaky notion that, you know, I'm sitting here occupying the space something else is occupying, but then of course I am no mass. Oh, well, I am mass. I don't quite. But there's something here about this. The next thing you know, he'll be 3 feet back of his head looking at himself. So, as an example of the workability of this particular process, the holdouts, which is to say the few who had not exteriorized cleanly in the advanced clinical course in London, are reported to have exteriorized all the holdouts. You know, he had maybe three or four there that were just dead in their heads, right there at the last. He exteriorized this whole unit, by the way, and he got down to R222. That was the total processes used. All of R1 and R222, that exteriorized everybody in that unit, I think, in the first 2 weeks of its teaching. Now, the holdouts, the people who were having difficulty blue on this one. Give me something you wouldn't mind occupying the same space. Give me something you wouldn't mind occupying the same space. Give me something else you would not mind occupying your same space. See? And they finally blew out of their heads. It's obvious to an individual who is interiorized that he is his body because he knows two things cannot occupy the same space. That's the first thing you want to learn about that. The other thing is the only reason the universe can stand out here and the terminals can interchange or anything else is because the postulate is woven thoroughly into this universe and everyone is convinced of it. Indeed, the two things can't occupy the same space. Now, if it's just a theory, as I told you before, devil with it. It's not a theory. It happens to have been something which was worked out on a theoretical basis along with 89 other theories that sounded just logical. But this one happened to work, and our research auditing demonstrated its workability, and in the hands of auditors ever since this was released, this has been a very workable technique and has been responsible for many case recoveries, particularly recovery of the ability to be. An individual can't be anything very cleanly. If he believes he can't occupy the same space as something. Look, a Thetan doesn't have any mass. He doesn't have any wavelength. He doesn't have any position unless he says he has. Well, if this is the case, and if he believes two things can't occupy the same space, then the only thing that he could do to be something, you see, would be in the same space as that something and consider himself absolutely nothing without quality, personality, or anything else. So he would be something fixedly, wouldn't he? Why would he be obsessed? Once he was in this thing, whatever it was, being it, whether a bedpost or a president, whatever he was, he would certainly be that thing. Wouldn't he have an identity, though? He would be a symbol. The definition of a symbol is mass, meaning, and mobility. Therefore, he would not be an orientation point. You have to be an orientation point in order to perceive. Let's follow that through quickly. You see my point. All right. If this individual believes two things can't occupy the same space and he is being something, then he won't be able to be anything else. You hang a medal on him and tell him he's a hero, and he's it. You say to him with some holy water, your name is John Jones, and boy, he's it. He couldn't be Bill Smith suddenly. And yet, his whole survival depends upon his ability to assume a number of identities. His survival depends upon his versatility, not his fixed being. His survival depends upon not his ability to call himself by different names, but to be different attributes, because a man has to adjust the environment to him. And if he's going to adjust the environment to him, he will have to be able to occupy certain parts of the environment and change them. Otherwise, he will stand there as a fixed mass being adjusted all the time by the environment. A rock is adjusted by the environment. The wind blows across it, erodes it, the rain washes on it, the birds chip pieces out of it, the earthquakes break it in half, and the lightning pushes it into dust. That's adjusting to the environment. Now, an individual who has the idea that two things can't occupy the same space, of course, the second he finds himself in a trap, is the trap. And you never saw a trap get out of a trap, did you? A Thetan can get out of a trap, but a trap doesn't get out of a trap. So he believes that he can be things at will and independently and change his beingness, or grant beingness, or receive beingness, if he believes that two things cannot occupy the same space. R110 is then an important process, is it not? Don't forget that process. Someday you'll be up against it. You'll be up against it with some preclear. You won't exteriorize, won't do something. Hammer and pound, what things wouldn't you mind occupying your space? More things you wouldn't mind occupying your space. Don't think you'll do it in 5 minutes, though. You won't. It'll take a lot longer than that. It's a long process, not a short one. And when he's exteriorized, you ask him the same thing, and all of a sudden it's a Thetan. He suddenly realizes, hey, you know, I really can be something. Oh, this will be a wonderful sensation to him. The important process. Okay.
This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 10th of October, 1954. The title of this lecture is Route 1, Step 11. This tape is 15 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Okay.
Here we have, now, Route 1, Step 11, R111. Have pre-clear be problems and solutions in havingness. And this would, of course, be sequitur in having disabused him of his most favorite idea that two things cannot occupy the same space, having disabused him of this obvious, known, practical, and convincing idea. We would be able to go on to R111. Or, having failed utterly to disabuse him of it, you know, having failed utterly in R110, we would go on to R111. Now, you see, you could fail in R110. You could fail by not running it long enough, by having a preclear who's having a lot of difficulty while exteriorized, by having had this preclear be sloppily audited before. You know, there'd be various reasons. And you've asked him this question, what things wouldn't you mind occupying your same space? And boy, he's vague, and he's this way and that. And after you run it for a little while, he gets unhappy, and then you get it kind of flat. But you're not satisfied with it at all. You could actually just go on to R111. You weren't getting any place with it. That's not to encourage you to change a process just because it isn't getting a result. And I'm just telling you that R111 is independent of R110. Why is it? Well, we're in a basic process again, you see? And do you know that all those basic processes, conceding the fact that the remedy of havingness and spotting spots are actually very much associated with each other, all those basic processes are workable processes. And here we've simply moved on to two-way communication. And we'll see back here at the beginning, we ask him if he had any present time problems. You know, we got into communication by talking about problems. Well, here, tucked way down here at R111, we have a basic process. This is a basic process. You could have started a process of this character the first time you ever talked to him. You could have started this process if you just had been introduced to him. And so it's got to be in R1 someplace, so it's just there. It's not dependent on the one bucket, blow it. Problems and solutions in havingness. Now, you'll also discover this over here in a later process, won't you? You will discover that this could have followed opening procedure by duplication. And you'll find it again appearing as R220, use of problems and solutions. Another way to run it, but it's still a very basic process, two-way communication. It's a problem that you're in communication with him at all. So this fellow's exteriorized, and we use this form when we have somebody out of his body. You know, he's exteriorized. He's an awareness unit. He's aware of his differentiation. He's somewhere up close to clear. He's still associated with energy masses or something of the sort. Well, a thetan is unhappy unless he can have a few problems, and so on. And you could ask him, what kind of a problem can you be in havingness? Specialized, you see. What kind of problem could you be in havingness? It's rather significant, but he will give you some problems he could be in having this. Let me see. I could be a pauper, and I could be this and that. And all of a sudden, it will occur to him sooner or later as you're asking that question over and over again, I could be exteriorized. That's one of the reasons he's not stabilizing outside. He's being a problem in having this. You know, there's the body, and there he is. He should be in the body. If he's in the body, he has it. Actually, he's having to hide, protect, and own bodies in order to be happy in life. Well, that's a problem of havingness. Hiding bodies, hiding objects, hiding gold, burying treasure, that's a problem in havingness. Hiding, protecting, owning, these are problems in havingness. So you just go on asking this, what kind of a problem can you be in havingness? Well, we've sometimes used this along this line. What kind of a problem can you be in havingness? And then what kind of a problem can you be in not havingness? Just to shake it up. You know, to give him the idea. He gets havingness as a positive and not havingness as a negative affair. And this is just to make sure that you're covering all squares. So you'd ask him this question. He's exteriorized. And say, what kind of problem can you be in havingness? What's another kind of a problem could you be in havingness? And you'd run that until its comm lag was pretty flat. And then you would say, what kind of a problem can you be in not havingness? And give him some more problems you could be in not havingness. More problems you could be in not having this. And then we could run it a little longer until that communication lag was flat on that. And then we could ask him on exteriors, what kind of a problem can others be to you in having this? And again, what kind of problem could others be to you in having this? And then we'd say, what kind of a problem can others be to you in not having this? And right away he gets the feeling of the walls pulling the energy out of him as a Thetan, you know. Parasites, people standing around. What kind of a problem can others be to you in not having this? Brings up immediately the vacuum cleaner quality of this particular universe. It really pulls the energy out of people. And we would go on with that till its leg was flat, and then we could go into solutions and say, what kind of a solution can you be to having this? What kind of a solution can you be to not having this? In other words, we just use those questions. But every time we use a solution, we have reduced his problems, haven't we? You see, a lot of the places on the track where you find this individual stuck, it's when he's got attained suddenly a solution. What's a basic solution? What is the ultimate solution? The ultimate solution is demonstrated by this proposition. The solution to a problem is the problem. This is demonstrated in perfect duplication. The solution to a problem is the problem. If you have a solution to a problem, which is the problem, in other words, if you have duplicated the problem perfectly, the problem will cease to exist and you will have no energy, no mass, no location in space, and no time. Won't you? In other words, the solution to the problem is the problem. But the second that you did that perfect duplicate, you would have as is the problem, which would leave you with nothing. So solutions are the most destructive things to having this you ever saw in your life. Fellow gets a real top flight solution, he'll wind up with nothing, won't he? And that is what people kick about when you talk to them about exteriorization. It is a solution. It is the solution to existence. Naturally. It has no further wavelengths. And a fellow actually can exteriorize into no position in time, you see, or location in space. I mean, if he can't place himself somewhere, he's in bad shape, but he basically can simply place himself somewhere, not being any place, you see. And he'd be an orientation point. But what a silly thing this is. People fight away from having solutions. Do you know that you got a black five and you ask him to really solve something, you know, make a perfect duplicate of the problem? He'd start to get sick at his stomach. You've asked him to look at nothing. Every time you ask one of these fellows who is figure, every time you ask one of these fellows to actually get a solution to the problem, he's liable to get sick. One of the finest things that to make a person sick you ever saw in your life is come along, for instance, and point out the solution to the problem. The ultimate solution is nothingness. Be 3 feet back of your head. Now he's in perfect condition. But after a person has gone downscale to a point where he's very heavily embedded in energy and so forth, now nothingness becomes very antipathetic for him to look at. So if you start asking him about solutions, you start asking him, willy-nilly asking him about what solutions he's had in the past. Give me some solutions you've arrived at. You know, he'll get sad. You give him some things. Well, now, what problems have you had in life? For a little while, until he gets the bank brain down too much. Why, he gets happier and happier and happier, you know. Oh, my parents were so mean to me, and my father beat me, and my mother beat my father, and they both beat my little brother, and that made me beat my dog. And we all never had anything to eat but chicken and ice cream, and we had no place to sleep but a feather bed. Boy, I've had problems, problems, problems. I'm just about out of my mind. And you say, now, what solutions have you had in the past? What are some of your solutions? Solutions? Have I ever had a solution? Okay, let's see. Solutions. Solutions. Yes, I had one. I left my family. It was a solution. Let's see. You trace back down the track and you find out that every solution is a reduction in happiness. You got that? Well, you dog, are sitting there asking a preacher to solve his case. Bells ring. He's liable just to sit there and give you more and more and more and more and more problems and more arduous and more involved and further down the line and so forth. Why? Because it'd make him awfully unhappy, he feels. If he is his body, a solution to the body is to have the body disappear utterly. You get in religion the fact that a great saint is supposed to be able to dematerialize his body. A I don't know what he's dragging the body for or where he's taking it to. But this is supposed to be the stuff. That's just a booby trap on the line, you think. Actually, he himself is no mass. Well, a person has to be willing to solve something before he'll exteriorize. It's a little maxim I give you and bequeath to you. He has to be willing to attempt a solution before he will exteriorize. And he won't attempt a solution until he has a great number of problems. And until he knows, down to the core of his awareness of awareness, that he can dream up problems ad infinitum. So what's the goal of this process? He's a little bit unhappy about being exteriorized. He feels calmer, he feels better, but there's something a little bit queasy about it, unstable about it, and so forth. Well, the best thing that you can do to him, really, is show him that he hasn't had his hattiness go all to pieces. He can always have something more. Actually, being exteriorized and being free, he can now have far more easily than previously. Well, you just don't tell him that. You run this process, and he'll convince himself of it. Now, what problems can you be in hattiness? And on and on and on. What's the limit and goal of the process? He'll at first believe that he could get a great many problems. He starts to invent them after a while, you see. You didn't tell him to invent them, but he will have to because he's drained the bank flat, which makes him very unhappy. He's got all problems which are obvious. Now he has to start dreaming them up. You say, now what about this business about problems? In headiness now, problems in headiness. How many of these do you think you could dream up? Oh, I could dream up quite a few. That's not the answer you're looking for. The answer you're looking for is, I could probably go on forever dreaming up problems in headiness and not headiness. Got that? I could probably go on forever. In other words, he has to have some conviction that he can invent an infinity of problems in headiness and not headiness. He must be able to invent an infinity of it and know that he can for him to stay stably exteriorized. Follow me? It's a very important process then, isn't it? But then we said that in a two-way communication, you could just keep asking a fellow, what kind of problems could you be to yourself? What kind of problems could you be to yourself? What kind of problems can you be to yourself? What kind of problems can you be to yourself? Give me some more problems that you could be to yourself. Some more problems you could be to yourself, and then for a little variation, what problems could others be to you? What problems could others be to you? What problems could others be to you? At first, it'd be a limited number, but quite a few. First, he's hard put for them. He doesn't want to surrender any. Now he starts dreaming some up. He could invent quite a few. Now he can invent an infinity of them. If he can invent an infinity of problems, he can exteriorize. Why? Because the solution is zero. The ultimate solution is zero. Recently I discovered the ultimate truth and the ultimate solution. Prove it too. It's right in your axioms in the printed edition. The ultimate truth and the ultimate solution. They're quite obvious. Therefore, an individual who is short on problems will not exteriorize. He has problems in lieu of objects. He has problems in lieu of hattiness. You better have him have an infinity of problems before you go on upstairs to heavier masses. Okay? Very well. I hope you know how to run that particular process now. You should, because it's right there in two-way communication. And it's no different than that. You could ask this same thing that you would ask him in a two-way communication. What kind of problems could you be to yourself? What kind of problems could you be to yourself? All kinds of machines will start to show up, and all kinds of problem machines and so forth. That'll stop him from using all his daffy machinery, by the way, all his daffy machinery that he keeps inventing and showing up with and asking you to unmock and so forth. That's all set up there so he can have infinity of problems. He has problem-making machines and a problem-making family, and he has a problem-breaking-down car. Okay. That's all.